Hello, welcome to the Above Average Irrelevance podcast. This is episode 4, and today is Wednesday, March 2nd. I'm Matt Weaver, and I'm here with Scott Nelson. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Matt.
How are you doing?
I am doing well. How about you?
I'm doing great. I'm starting my second cup of coffee, and I'm vibrating here in my seat. I'm ready to go.
Me as well. I have my caffeinated decaf depth charge.
That's right. You've got some strange...
For my second cup, decaf coffee with a shot of caffeinated espresso. So I get strong coffee, but no jitters.
If that's what works for you. All right. So just before we started recording here, we got on the topic of broadly termed helping people on the internet. And you and I were both agreeing that there is an art to being able to wade through reviews of something, either on TripAdvisor or on Stack Overflow or on Amazon.com, right? Where people are writing about their experiences. And most of the time, people write very badly. And so there's something to be that you can learn from those in how you write on the internet, as well as the art of being able to quickly determine whether somebody is just a whiner and whether their review can be discounted. Maybe in addition to, you know, a like button, what we need is a useless button. Right, like
yeah, you know, and they do that, like they do that on Amazon. You know, X out of Y people thought this review was useful, but I don't pay attention to that, and they don't really seem to like.
I think it needs to go the other way. I think they need to have a. This was unhelpful.
Yeah,
this was actively bad, and it needs
like
to
a like, bury it button. You
right,
know, that's something Dig originally yeah. introduced, and it hasn't really stuck around. The concept of make this go away.
Yeah.
With a click.
Yeah. Well, the example that we were talking about was I have reviewed on TripAdvisor the hotel, at least that at the time I reviewed it, was the hotel closest to the entrance of Universal Studios in Florida. And TripAdvisor is always sending me emails that say, you know, you're in the top 25% of reviewers and your review has been seen by insert some absurd number. Here, right? So I have managed to leave a couple of reviews at popular places, and it might be inappropriate or wrong for me to say, but I would like to think that I try to write relatively good reviews, if only because I try to be somewhat conscious of what would someone reading this review want to get out of it, not what do I want to complain about?
Right.
And so, for instance, in this review for this hotel in Florida, you know, my review included things like it's very close to the entrance, but you're not going to walk to Universal Studios from there because even though the entrance is very close, where you turn off the road onto the Universal Studios property is actually a really long way from where the entrance to the parks are. But the hotel has a shuttle, which you can take, and you know there are some restaurants near the hotel that are within easy walking distance, right? These are the things that I was looking for when I was trying to determine if this hotel was valuable to me, and so I had to wade through a lot of unhelpful reviews in order to find the information I was looking for. So I tried to kind of ball all that up into my review of the place and leave it, and I can only guess that that has been helpful. At least I hope it has been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you have to do like real-time filtering when you're reading these reviews.
Yeah.
And I have very specific things that just I don't care about. And it's usually people complaining that somebody was rude to them. You see that a lot in the reviews, like the help staff was rude to me. I didn't feel like they wanted me there. Wah, wah. You know, well,
I don't care.
I don't care.
you're probably crazy.
If my room is clean, I have everything I need, I don't get overcharged, you know, like, I don't really care. They can be rude to me, you know, like, I have to speak to the front desk for like 2 minutes, right, in my stay. So I discount those. You know, I don't really care lots of times about the breakfast, the continental breakfast. People will be like, the donuts were stale, 1 star. Like, well, I rarely even eat the breakfast at a hotel I stay at.
Yeah. Don't eat the donuts.
What's the point? Yeah. I mean, if it's about like cleanliness of the room, safety,
I got insects, bed bugs.
Yeah. Things like that are important.
I wonder if there's a business opportunity here. I wonder if I could have a website like howtowritereviews.com and sell a $5 PDF download that would be 10 pages of telling the completely self-absorbed people on planet Earth how to not be self-absorbed and write a review that someone else might find valuable.
Well, what would be better off is through, like, you know, natural language processing to evaluate reviews and be able to say, you know, I could be able to define what's important to me, and then we would parse out all the reviews and decide, you know, whether or not something that is important to me was rated, you know, good or bad.
The real Silicon Valley answer, right? Yeah. If only we had a better algorithm.
Right. Exactly. Amazon, it happens all the time on Amazon too, when you read reviews and it'll be like, I got delivered the wrong product, 1 star. You realize you're writing a review for the product, and you've just admitted that you didn't even get delivered the product, so you couldn't possibly review it.
Right.
You know, so like when people are reviewing the shipping or the customer service interaction with Amazon, like, I feel bad then for if it's a like a book or a CD for like the author of the material. It's like, you know, they had no opportunity to make that be a 5-star review because of the customer service experience. Well, I mean, those reviews should just go away. Like, it they're not helping anything.
Yeah.
I don't know if Amazon does that. You know, if a review is marked as not helpful, you know, X percentage of the time, then does it have less weight in figuring the star average? It should.
I bet you the internet knows the answer to that question. Mm. We should look it up. Maybe the buttons about was this review helpful or not factor into how reviews are ordered on Amazon, and maybe I should spend more time clicking on them than I do.
So here's my problem. I have clicked on them before. It makes you log in because it like wants to track that information. I suppose that's so you can't just like vote down a review a million times. But I mean, they could do that with cookies or something else. Like anytime
I'm always logged in Amazon in my browser, though. I mean, aren't you?
I can't remember. Sometimes it, I mean, if you're going to make a purchase, it makes you enter your credentials again.
Yeah.
I think it does that if you try and rank or rate a review. I don't know. I've hit it before and been like, no, never mind. Like, I'll help you until you make it.
Until,
like,
the friction overcomes
Exactly. Yeah. And that friction is just a teeny tiny bump. No.
Yeah. Fair enough. All right. Let's get to the thing that I've been kind of burning on all week. Let's talk about the Oscars.
Okay.
And I don't care that Leo won. Great. I'm happy for him. I didn't think that was his best performance, but whatever. The thing that I want to complain about is Best Original Song, Writings on the Wall by Sam Smith. I really don't like this song. And that it won just kind of blows my mind. I don't know. I mean,
see, and you're going to get no argument from me. I wish you were talking with somebody who loves the song and could make the counterpoint. You know, I love Sam Smith in the Lonely Hour album. I think he's a very interesting singer, great voice.
Yeah.
I just, like, when I first saw Spectre and, you know, the opening credits rolled, did I see it with you? I don't know. Whoever I saw it with, I turned and I'm like, this song is terrible.
I think we saw it together because we both had the same reaction. Like, this is a horrible song. This is the worst opening Bond song that we've had in a long time.
And I think if I would have first heard the song on the radio or listening to an album or something, I probably wouldn't have had the same reaction. But in the context of a Bond film song, I just didn't like it. Like, I don't think it's fitting. Yeah. You know, it didn't get me excited to see the movie. It didn't have the qualities that I expect from a Bond theme. And I'm sure that's what they were going for. It's something different, you know, some interesting new direction of Bond themes.
But I'm not having it. There's no interesting new direction for Bond movies. They've made, what, 25 of them? They're all the same.
Right.
And clearly we all show up to watch it, so... Didn't like it.
I'm with you.
I thought that was a swing and a miss for the Academy.
Well, and that's the thing. You know, what I just said about in the context of a... You know, the Bond film, I didn't care for it. That is the context, because it's an Academy Award, right?
Exactly.
It's for movies. It's for a song's contribution to the movie it was in, right? I mean, isn't that as important as just the quality of the song itself?
Yes.
I mean, they've shown in the past, there are cases where, like, the best song does not always win. It's, like, the best package of a song, and its theme, and, you know, how it was included in the movie, and...
So what should have won?
Well, I would have voted for the Gaga song.
Till It Happens to You.
Yes.
From The Hunting Ground.
Part of it was, you know, I had never heard that song until I watched the awards. And it was just a very moving performance. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, Lady Gaga is an outstanding performer.
Yep.
So just seeing them on the show, that to me, hands down, that's the winner.
So I did not see the performances... at the Oscars, because it's on TV and I...
Okay, we can get to that next.
But I did go listen to the songs on the internet afterwards, and I'm with you. Till It Happens to You, I thought was the best song of all of the nominated songs. So... All right, so...
I did experience the pain of actually watching the Oscar telecast from beginning to end on a TV with commercials. And it was painful. So painful. Well, first of all, it went over like it always does. So it started at 7:30, which, you know, I think they used to start it at 7. And a few years ago, to accommodate West Coast a little better, you know, they moved it to 7:30. And so now the published running time is 7:30 to 10:30. And it was past 11 before it was done. It was like 11:05 or something. So it's a long ass show.
Right. Well, that's 11:05 for us Central Time.
Right. So East Coast. I mean, and the Oscars are a very East Coast thing, right? There's a lot of...
Yeah.
Many more people watching the Oscars in Eastern Time Zone than in the Mountain middle. Time Zone, yeah. You know? Yeah. So it's very late program for them. But it just was too long. And they do this thing where they give one award and then have a commercial and give one award and have a commercial. And it just, like, when you're not used to watching commercials anymore, which I'm not, it's like...
I mean, the last time I watched anything significant with commercials in it, right, where the TV wasn't just on in the background in a bar or over at somebody's house, right, was the Super Bowl. And half the point is the commercials, right? But for everything else, the commercials kind of... drive me crazy, and it makes me turn the TV off anymore.
I guess the problem is I don't have a DVR. If you had a DVR, all you do is you start recording it, and then at 8:30 you start watching it.
Yeah, but having a DVR these days is like saying you've got the best VHS in 2000.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the wrong technology for the future. I don't know. I suppose TiVo and whomever are still selling DVRs, but I don't know why you would have a DVR anymore.
I mean, that's the only solution.
I don't
solution,
want it.
Though.
I just want to hit the button and stream it, right?
I don't know, but I feel like this is an unsolved problem because I want to watch the Oscars when they're on TV. I don't want to get all the winners spoiled. I don't want to have to wait until the next day when it shows up on this other place where sometimes I watch things.
I was doing something on Sunday night and I just had a tab open in the browser and it was just a live tweet storm past. So it was like, oh, you know, so, whatever won, right? And that's all I needed.
I had a problem with something similar when I was watching the Super Bowl. I watched it at somebody's house where somebody was coming late, so we didn't start it until like an hour after the game started.
Right.
Usually when you're watching a ball game, that's okay. That's ideal, in fact, because then you can fast forward through all the commercials. But when it's the Super Bowl, you know,
you want to watch the commercials.
So when there was like, I don't know, the last quarter of the game was just starting, I get a notification on my phone, New York Times, of who has won the Super Bowl. So that's a problem. New York Times, I don't think they did. I actually like getting notifications from New York Times because I feel like, you know, I know what's happening when a news story happens. But they shouldn't be posting a notification of who just won the Super Bowl.
Well, or you should turn it off. You've admitted you were an hour behind the rest of the world, so it's that's responsibilities on you now.
I guess I did not realize that that was going to happen in the future.
Maybe if you took your watch off, you would be better.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. But I don't think they spoiled the Oscars for anybody. They must not care that much.
No. So, I saw who was winning by live tweets on the internet. After the fact, later that night, I went to YouTube and I watched the 10-minute Chris Rock monologue, which I thought was pretty good. And I felt I got enough of the Oscars that way.
Yeah.
I've probably spent more time complaining about who won Best Original Song than I actually spent watching the Oscars.
So aside from the length and the commercials, I didn't think it was a great broadcast in general. Like, Chris Rock is a great host.
Yeah.
I feel like his hands were kind of tied about the type of comedy he needed to do because of the controversy.
Yeah, but he charged right at it, and I thought he did a great job.
He did. The opening monologue was great.
Yeah.
I thought it was spot on, the way he approached that, the humor. Like, I really enjoyed it. But then I actually went back and looked, and there were 7 other, like, bits or, things dealing with the... racial diversity in the Oscars. So by the end of the program, it just got to be a little tedious.
Yeah.
Because it was just over and over and over again. So I don't know. It was like that became the theme. You know, some years they have a theme for the Oscar, for the Oscar telecast. This year, there wasn't really a defined theme, but this became the theme, right? The theme of the show was, we're going to bring attention, draw attention to the fact that there's no diversity in Hollywood.
Well, we can hope that we don't need that theme in the future, and it just naturally happens. That would be ideal.
They even had Sacha Baron Cohen came out as the Ali G. Did you ever watch Ali G show on
HBO? I don't know any of the words you just said to me.
Okay. I love the Ali G show. But he's like this wannabe black guy. Like, he, you know, has the big sunglasses and booyah kasha, and, you know, like, talks in this, like...
And I think
slang.
He's a white guy.
Right? Yeah, he's like a British guy. A white British guy. But, you know, that show's been off forever. And, like, the Ali G movie was, you know, I don't know, 8-10 years ago. And so they, like, brought him out of retirement, you know, to do a bit about him being the token black guy.
Right.
You know, and then he got to make a joke about Idris Elba and... Darth Vader as a black actor. Like, he had a couple funny lines,
right?
But it was just so, like, forced, right? Like, sure. we're gonna you know, I don't know, I guess, I don't know, maybe it makes me a bad person for saying that, it was just too much.
Yep. No, I understand what you're telling me,
and the thing is it's not something that can be immediately fixed. Right? Like, it's going to be a number of... Even if people say today, okay, we need to make more diverse movies, well, maybe there can be some change by next year. But, I mean, it takes 2, 3, 5, 10 years to make a movie, right? You know, movies are in development forever. It's not like we can, like, immediately change this. So that was the thing that was odd to me. Yes, we've drawn attention to the problem, but then, like, the continued urgency as if it's something that's going to be fixed, you know, something that they were going to fix Sunday night, right? If they just, like, said it enough times...
So maybe you were feeling like you were being punished for a problem you didn't cause.
Right.
Didn't have any influence
on. Maybe that's it. Maybe that's it, yeah. Right? I mean...
Yeah, I don't know. All right, next topic. Let's talk about fitness. So I saw an article on The Economist. Actually, I heard them talk about it on one of The Economist's podcasts. But they're... is or will soon be an article, a peer-reviewed journal entry that says, that reveals why it is that exercise helps combat cancer. I think we have known for a long time that people who exercise regularly have less incidences of cancer, and... people who exercise, even after they have a tumor, the exercise helps combat tumor growth, right? And so some researchers were injecting nearly endless supply of mice with different types of cancer, and they determined they both, you know, reconfirmed again that exercise does have a material impact on cancer, and then they determined that it's both adrenaline and an additional chemical, which is hard to pronounce and I don't remember off the top of my head, are the two important chemicals that are released during exercise that combat cancer. And they determine the, you know, how that works, right? And they prove that those chemicals in isolation without the exercise also have the effect on cancer in mice anyway. And so the not only having the empirical data to say, you know, exercise helps with cancer, but having, you know, specific
why
it's these chemicals and this is how it happens, at least in mice, I thought was important, because it has the potential to improve humans' ability to withstand and recover from cancer, especially people who are incapable of exercising because
or don't want to. Now I can just take the pill, right?
Maybe,
as the adrenaline.
As it turns out, there are other benefits to moving your patootie around, and I think any rational doctor would encourage you to do that. But if you're, you know, if
synthetic you're, exercise,
if you're old or infirm, or if you've got something, you know, broken leg or something that's going to prevent you from exercising, we know a little bit more now, and I thought that was important to mention.
I am infirm, but it's a whole other definition.
I'm infirm because of my own reasons.
You know, I haven't. You just told me about this morning, so I kind of skimmed the article, but I think that's awesome. Like I think exercise is often the best medicine. I just took this course on Coursera. It was called Learning How to Learn.
Okay.
It was actually very good. It was just like a 4-week course. It was basically all about, you know, how to approach learning new material, how to prepare for test taking, how the brain works and how you can use that to your advantage depending upon what you want to learn and how you want to learn it. It was a very interesting course. They stressed several times the importance of exercise in learning. And there were a number of reasons. I mean, some of it is just, you know, clearing your head. You know, I read something and then by going for a walk, going for a run, I clear my head and, you know, my brain has time to fully process it and kind of commit some of that to different memory centers. And so there was the actual, you know, what's going on chemically when you exercise. And then there was also just the, you know, it makes you feel better. It, you know, improves your mood. You know, it makes you want to come back and learn more, right? Just taking the break. And,
yeah, no, absolutely. It can be when you're feeling down and tired, you know, sitting on the couch seems more interesting than getting up and going for a run or doing something along those lines. But
so I guess I'm never surprised then to hear about another additional health benefit of exercising.
Yeah. So that article just, it caught my eye. It didn't seem like it was a huge thing, but it seems like it's one of those things that could end up being quite important. So I just wanted to highlight it here. All right. So let's talk about the connected car. So there was an Ars Technica article. Apparently Nissan Leafs had some connected car app that some security researchers discovered had basically no security controls on it at all. All you needed was the VIN number of the car, and then you could access it over the internet, and, you know, do things like turn on the air conditioner and other seemingly innocuous things. But, The thing that really struck me was I have stated that my next car should be something that supports Apple's CarPlay because I don't believe that the auto manufacturers can design a for lack of a better term, an entertainment stack in a car that's going to be valuable or interesting or useful to me over the life of the car. My current car is 13 years old, right? And it's being close to being ready to be replaced, but the, you know, like my car has a tape deck in it, right? And
which we've discussed is better than my car because it has a CD player with no auxiliary audio jack. So yes. I got nothing.
So my
At least
car is,
you can use a tape adapter.
Right. So my car is so old that it works out well, but the when you think about what's it going to be over the next 10 years, you know, whatever system is in a car today, you know, if I went and bought a new Cadillac with Cadillac's Q system in it, I mean, you'd have to live with that turd for forever, right? And perhaps this is just an artifact of how I choose to own cars. You know, I buy them and I keep them for a long time. if I was just leasing a new car every 2 or 3 years, maybe it wouldn't be a big deal. But the fact is, I don't think the car companies get it. I think, for lack of a better choice, if I can just, you know, plug my iPhone into the dash and do whatever's on the iPhone in the car, that's the best I could hope for going forward. But what this article and other articles along it are like tell me maybe I don't want a car that has any sort of connected features in it. Because not only can I not trust the auto manufacturers to produce a valuable and interesting entertainment stack in the middle, I can't trust the auto manufacturers to have proper and appropriate security for the car connected to the internet. And, you know, several of my friends would tell me to take off my tinfoil hat and not worry about it, and it's software and all the bugs will get updated and whatever else. And maybe that's true, but it hasn't been proven yet, I don't think, that auto manufacturers are really going to care about these cars when they get older. I mean, how many years into the future is Ford or Nissan going to produce security updates for the stupid software they saddled me with in their car, right? Who knows how many security flaws are in my old car, but it doesn't matter.
Right, because it's not hackable.
You literally have to walk up to it and find a place to plug something into it, right? Which limits the impact of it, but if my car is connected to the internet and it requires no security whatsoever to access it in some way.
Yeah, there's two problems there. I mean, obviously the security problem, that's really unforgivable to have like a non-protected API where you need the VIN number and it's so hard to get the VIN number for a car, you know, like look at the windshield.
Or guess.
Yeah, just start generating.
VIN numbers are often created in an algorithmic way. You can decode them to learn things about the date and the place where the car was manufactured and whatnot. So anyway, but
yeah, so I wonder if that's because the people who are writing the software or whoever was writing the web-based component for that software, I don't know, maybe they just aren't, you know, kind of up to speed on internet security. Like maybe, I don't know, who are the software engineers that are employed by Nissan? Are they the people who have been there, you know, since the beginning and they used to program for
but it's probably
audio
not
systems
Nissan.
Or something?
I mean, Nissan probably didn't build this system from scratch.
So you think
they
it's probably subcontracted or something?
Well, they probably bought it from a supplier, right? I mean, there are
in that case, if it's someone who is, you know, their specialty is building web-based car interactive services, that makes it even worse. Right?
But how many people on planet Earth have that specialty, web-based car interactive services? Yeah, I mean, that job has existed for about 8 seconds on planet Earth. But there are tons of professionals that know a lot about web security, but it didn't, you know, car manufacturers didn't think to hire them. I don't know. I'm sure this will eventually be something that is solved and I don't have to worry about. But it feels like right now we're in the Wild West,
right?
And do you want something that you're going to potentially regret for the life?
Well, and your second point, I mean, definitely if in this case where it's like a web-based component, you know that's going to go away at some point in the future. This happens all the time. This happens with game consoles. This happens with any public API that somebody uses, right? Like, it's there for X number of years after the release of the device.
Yep.
And then they shut it down. And if you're still using the device and you're still using the networked component, too bad, buy the new thing. In this case, it's unfortunately going to be buy a new car.
Yeah, like the NBA 2K13, 2K14 games or whatever, right? Those big sports games, right? I mean, they run those servers for a couple years and then shut them down.
Well, I got burned bad when I could no longer play Dr. Mario online on the Nintendo Wii.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like, it ruined my life. No, but I mean, they did. They shut down the Wii. They shut down the Wii network. It was like, no more multiplayer game. Yep. Sorry. We know you paid for this game. We know you paid for this console. But
no.
The same thing happens, you know, with PlayStation and with Xbox and multiplayer.
Yeah.
Stops working.
So, I don't know. Maybe I'm just an old guy standing out there telling people to get off my lawn. But
yeah. I guess the kind of the redeeming factor with that is you're always going to be able to change the temperature in your car with a button or a dial inside the car.
I don't know.
If you lose the ability to do it with your phone, so what?
So my friend has a 2015 Lincoln MKC, which is the last year that they had the Ford Sync 2 systems in them, not the newer Ford Sync 3 systems, which are the ones that are supposed to eventually get Apple CarPlay support. But I'm trying to remember now. His dash has a big screen in it with some buttons on it. But I think... I'm pretty sure that you can control the HVAC using the touchscreen interface. There may be some buttons, some physical buttons for controlling that stuff too, but maybe not. And we're probably on the cusp of all of those buttons maybe going away.
Hmm.
So it's not clear to me that you will always be able to control basic things like Windows and HVAC and stuff with a physical button. Probably, but not necessarily. And
I think that's the only way to really completely future-proof yourself, right? Is to have a mechanical way.
But it's probably not mechanical. I'm sure in his car, even the physical buttons to control that stuff are probably just providing inputs into a computer to control that stuff. I mean, I know that the...
Well, right. I mean, that's the same way in my current car. It's like turning the thing isn't actually opening a vent, but at least it's a exposed control, right? So if the LCD screen dies,
yeah,
I guess if the computer behind it dies, it won't work. But
if the computer is connected to the internet and they stop providing security updates for it, and your car gets a virus which makes that stop working, then maybe your car is stuck on heat.
Whether I have a knob or not,
yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's a crazy thing to say, but that's part of the. You know, the crazed, fearful lunatic that lives inside of me. That's what he worries about. All right. Well, maybe that leads us into the ongoing saga between Apple and the FBI, right? So Apple's filed their motion that says, you know, we're not gonna. And now it's...
Make us.
Yeah. Now it's... We're going. Right? I don't know. This is still a fascinating case. I've talked about it with some friends of mine, and I find one of the most interesting things I've found is a good friend of mine who often has different opinions than I do, but whom I respect very gratefully. You know, I respect him quite a lot and his opinions quite a lot, even though we disagree. He's not necessarily advocating for a police state, but he is kind of a, you know, like he was coming at it from, you know, there was this court order and Apple didn't comply, right? Like he has this his natural viewpoint is the villain is always the corporation. I think he has a very negative view of corporations and a more positive view of government. And so his whole opinion on this topic was colored by Apple as a corporation, and they must be the villain.
See, where my immediate reaction was Apple is the citizen, you know, like in their
right.
they're participating in civil disobedience, right?
Yeah, so, which is where I come from, right? Like I, yeah. my view is more that the government and the FBI here are villain isn't really the right word, but they're the villain in the story because they're the ones trying to overreach, and Apple is standing up for our rights, right, and trying to do the right thing. And so that completely colors my view on it as well. And it was fascinating to me to really understand this alternative point of view
mm-hmm.
where the default answer is the corporation is doing it wrong. And there are potentially a lot of cases where that's true. I don't want to say that he's wrong or that his opinion is wrong. But it's that coming from that point of view was illustrated for me. And my guess is a lot of people share that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll be an important factor as we move into the future. I mean, I'm an iPhone user. I'm a Macintosh user. I'm clearly an Apple fanboy.
Right.
For better or worse. So it's I'm predisposed to view Apple in a positive way.
Also, Apple's reputation, you know, for caring about customers and for being a likable corporation, right? If it was Verizon going against the FBI, would they have people rallying support behind them in the same manner that Apple is? Absolutely not.
Yeah, or Comcast, right? Does anybody like Verizon or Comcast or AT&T? I mean, these companies often always have very low customer satisfaction scores, right? So everybody's got their beef.
So Apple is benefiting from their positive reputation, you know, in rallying people for their cause.
Yeah, at least for me and others like me, right? I don't know. It's
I haven't really followed. So, you know, there's a lot of Apple haters. Are Apple haters, like, do they have to be against Apple on this? Like, anyone who is anti-Apple?
I don't.
Are they saying, just unlock the phone, come on?
Yeah, I don't think so. The Apple haters, like, I haven't seen a huge outpouring of, like, the Android, you know, I hate Apple crowd saying, you know, Apple's on the side of terrorists. Because they're still usually
technology-oriented
enough to understand the implications of what that means. It's my observation, my limited observation, that it is if you believe the government is right to do everything possible to combat what is perceived to be, you know, terrorism at any level, then these are the people who think that Apple is doing the wrong thing, right? There's, you know, I don't know if they're driven by fear or what, but they're, it's the crowd of people who are motivated to do everything possible against terrorism. And I have a couple of friends that are this way, and that kind of surprises me. And they'll claim an intellectual understanding of, you know, there is no amount of liberty that you can give up in the name of safety and security, right? They proclaim to understand that at an intellectual level, but when you get deeper into the discussion with them, it's clear that emotionally at their core, that's not where they're at, right? They're operating from a position of, I don't have anything to hide, and I don't want there to be a terrorist attack that might put me or my family at risk. You know, I demand that the government prevent it, and I'm willing to do anything to do it, right? That's their emotional response to it, which I can understand. I just don't agree with. But I don't know. I don't have children, so maybe I'm not predisposed to...
Yeah, well, Tim Cook made a compelling think of the children argument on his side of the case, too. Yeah. So privacy is important.
It is. This case is fascinating to me, and I'm sure we're going to talk about it for months to come.
There was a little bit of movement, you know, in the New York case, there was a ruling that Apple could not be compelled under the All Writs Act.
Oh, yeah, I saw that yesterday.
So in that case, I mean, you know, the San Bernardino case is the big one, but there was this other New York case that's kind of been there, too, and there was a ruling on in the district court. Right,
but that's in a different judicial jurisdiction than this other one. So,
correct.
Due to the weird way the courts work, that technically that...
It's not setting any precedent.
Doesn't set a precedent over in this other place, but...
Still an interesting development.
It is a legal opinion that's been rendered that's, you know... potentially valuable in the way the thinking is going with this particular case out west too.
Right.
So, I don't know. The world continues to talk about it, and it still continues to be interesting.
Well, and like we had kind of speculated last week about, you know, they're going to make it harder to hack it, whether that means putting something in the, you know, directly in the silicon itself what. And then, you know, there's an article in the New York Times like the next day that said, yes, this is what's happening. They're making it so it will be harder or impossible.
Impossible seems unlikely. Harder is always going to be the case, right? Clearly Apple is now motivated to do that.
Right.
It would be fascinating to, you know, sit on an airplane next to a cryptologist from the NSA and put a couple drinks in him on and ask him about, you know, what could this imply for the NSA's ability to break into an iPhone. And it's speculation, but I have to assume that they work at that. Simply because there are likely, you know, legitimate targets, international targets, for whom the espionage value is high and worth attempting to break into, right? Which is something that I have to assume that they do, right? I assume that they collect flaws for how to break into all kinds of systems, security systems, computers, phones, networks all over the world, right? That's that's their job, right? And so have the FBI kind of pushing against Apple in this public way to try to force them to do something that Apple clearly doesn't want to do, it's going to cause Apple to react and try to close off holes that the FBI is pushing on, right? And it makes me wonder, is the NSA use those same holes as well? I mean, it would seem the obvious point of entry for some of that stuff, right? And if Apple gets pushed and starts closing that stuff off, what does that do to the NSA? I mean, it has to make their job harder.
Thanks, guys.
maybe. But you would have to assume that they just accept that that's part of their job, right? I mean, they discover a hole. I mean, part of the, you know, one side of the NSA is supposed to report those holes back to the manufacturers and say, you've got a problem here, you should fix it, right? Because they're tasked both with protecting the security of the United States digital assets, right?
The other side is saying, take your time in reporting.
Right. The other side is trying to exploit those to gain intelligence.
Right.
They wear two hats, and those hats are sometimes not compatible. And it's always a balance that they've been trying to strike since the very existence of that place. And obviously we don't have a lot of visibility onto how they weigh those decisions. You just have to trust them, which I'll admit for me is hard to do. So... okay. Enough about that. I'm sure we'll keep talking about it every week.
Yeah.
What else you want to talk about?
You know, I to digress, I forgot to mention this during our Oscar segment. I rewatched Mad Max this week.
Mad Max Fury Road. Yeah.
So that was probably my favorite movie from last year, and I felt like it was well rewarded. You know, did you see it won a bunch of, I mean, it won
got like six technical costume awards.
Costume design, sound editing, sound mixing, production design, costume. I mean, it was well rewarded, and I think that it was well deserved. So that made me happy.
Yeah.
I mean, that movie was never going to win Best Picture, but I feel like it was kind of a tip of the hat to say that this movie did something very interesting and different and deserves to be rewarded for it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Fury Road. I think I saw it two or three times in the theater. I like the fact, I mean, I'm sure almost every frame of that movie has some sort of digital effect applied to it, but I like the fact that they built and drove around most of those crazy cars.
Out in the desert.
Yeah, out in the desert, right? It's like, you know, that really lends a lot of realism to it. And the parts that look the most fake, if that makes any sense, are the parts that are mostly CGI, right? With the big, you know, tornado dust storm scene, right? That looks totally, I don't know if it looks totally fake, but to me, when I watch it, it's like, oh, that seems, that's the most unbelievable. It
has at least unrealistic, yeah.
Right. Like, it didn't quite cross the uncanny valley simply because, you know, 90% of what's going on there is fake, right? And you can sense it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But the other stuff, right, with the giant monster trucks running into each other and jumping over and, you know, falling on their side and blowing up and stuff. I mean, that I'm sure all of that stuff is digitally enhanced, but there's a real thing there that people are really walking around on.
Yeah.
It adds a lot of realism, if that makes sense, in the context of a completely unbelievable, fanciful, you know, science fiction future.
Right. So this was my first rewatch since I saw it back in the theater a couple times, and it was still great. Like, I foresee this is going to be a movie I will continue to rewatch, you know, in the future.
Yep.
Every so often. And not a lot of movies fall into that category for me. Like, I'm not big into, you know, rewatching. I have a short list of movies that I tend to rewatch.
Right.
This might be one of them.
So, I mean, the movies named Mad Max, right? So clearly when they make the next one, and I assume they're going to make another one because it was so popular, obviously Mad Max will be back, right? The title character will be back because that's what the movie's about. But I really liked the Furiosa character, right? Like, I really want to see more of her story, but her story arc is, like, contained within that movie, right?
Exactly.
And,
I don't know, you know, if the first three movies are any indication, like, there's no set, kind of like set theme for those movies. You know, it didn't follow a set path. It kind of went all over the place.
Right.
So I think there's probably a lot of room in the reboot of that series to do whatever they want to do.
As long as we don't have the Thunderdome again.
Yeah. Is Tina Turner available? That actually would be hilarious to have her play some character.
Yeah, I think it would be fun. But, two men enter, one man leaves. No, thank you. Hopefully we've moved past that. So, yeah. I don't know, are there any good music you're listening to lately? No.
Not that I want to publicly confess.
Fair enough.
No, I had witnessed this the other night because I was playing with my phone, but I went and saw a high school production in town here of Little Shop of Horrors. Mm. So then I pulled out the soundtrack to that movie and was listening to that. It's interesting music. And it's on Apple Music. So
put that in your Hamilton playlist.
So I didn't have to pay anything for it.
Pay anything more for it.
Anything more? Yeah. I did have to pay $10.78 this month.
Yeah.
I'm still listening to Hamilton a lot, actually. We haven't talked about that on podcast. I'm kind of obsessed with it. I actually, somebody sent me this week, there's this song in there called the lyric is "I'm not throwing away my shot," and it's about Alexander Hamilton, you know, not throwing away his shot at greatness. Somebody was sending around, there's a parody of it called "Not Throwing Away My Spock," and it's like a Star Trek parody. It's really well done. It's really good. So
yeah.
So, you know, that, I don't know, you know, something, it's kind of odd. This musical has gotten so much press now and has become so big, you know, that it's really entered the mainstream like a Broadway show never really does. And when you have a Star Trek parody, like, you know that everyone knows about this musical.
It's officially crossed over into the mainstream. Yeah. Well, it's so far in the mainstream. I mean, I'm not a musical person. You know, I never went through a phase where I was listening to a bunch of musicals or, you know, doing any of that stuff. But I kind of want to see Hamilton, right? I mean, it seems, I don't know, it's big enough, important enough. I should seek it out. And whether it's traveling to New York to go see it on Broadway or to find a traveling show that's coming near me, you know, I should probably work to see it.
Me too. The best bet is going to be in Chicago. It's going to open in Chicago this fall and have a long-term run, like shows do in Chicago from time to time. I could see it running in Chicago for a number of years even.
Sure.
So that's probably our best opportunity to get to it.
Yeah, we should totally do that.
A friend and I looked at going on just a quick trip, a long weekend to New York City to see it, but it's just impossible. I mean, it's sold out like through the end of the year.
But I mean, not to take anything away from Chicago. It's a great town. I love to go and visit there. But I've spent more time in Chicago growing up in the Midwest as I have than I have in New York. I've been to New York literally once in my life and I had a fantastic time doing it. I'd love to go back.
So a reason to go to that destination probably isn't the worst thing.
No.
Well, get your pennies scraped together, because the only way to get tickets to it are to buy premium tickets.
And how much?
I don't even know. I'm guessing you'd probably spend at least a few $100.
In the context of money in New York, going on a trip to New York,
what the heck? Or you could they do this thing where you can go and wait in front of the theater and get in a lottery for the opportunity to buy like the front row seats for $20 or something. It's like a huge deal. But it's just it's a lottery, and literally thousands of people go every day.
I mean, I'm all for finding a good reason to go to New York and hang out. But if the reason is to go see Hamilton, then I feel like kind of need to have the tickets
ahead of time,
like squared away before you get there. Right. Cause you'd say, oh, well then you just got to come back. But to be honest, if I travel to New York, I don't want to spend a lot of time waiting around to maybe get tickets, right? Well, what a waste of time.
And for other shows, you could go and you could try and win the lottery. And if you didn't, then, you know, go up to the box office and pay your $300 or whatever and just buy a seat. But with this, I mean, it's like, there's no same day opportunity to get tickets. It's just impossible. So
surely this stuff is on StubHub and whatever, right?
Right. But that's why I'm saying, you know, you would have to spend probably $500-$600 if you're going to buy like an aftermarket ticket. Yeah. And there's been a huge problem with people selling counterfeit tickets.
Yeah.
Which have you read about that? No. That's never happened before really in the history of like Broadway productions.
And now it's happening.
It's happening because the demand is so high for those tickets.
So, well,
it's interesting. I think the phenomenon is fun as much as, you know, and it's great. It's really great music.
Yeah. Cause you've seen the show, right?
No.
Oh, you've just the music.
No.
Just a soundtrack. Okay.
Yeah. But I mean, I've been listening to it for a few months now and like it, not every day, but it hasn't gone away. You know, usually with a musical soundtrack,
a couple weeks,
someone tells me about it. Yeah. I'll listen to it. You know, you have to listen to it a few times to, you know, totally get the story, to kind of get the music in your ears, whatever. And then, you know, it goes on the shelf and I may literally never listen to it again.
Right.
I tend to like to buy musical soundtrack albums and I'll listen to them a few times and they go on the shelf to never be listened to again. This one will probably always stick around. It's that good.
Okay.
So
what you're saying is, we need to figure out how much it costs for Hamilton and go to New York.
And go, yeah, make it happen.
Okay. Well, on that note, I think we've had another successful podcast.
I concur.
All right. Until next week. Bye-bye.
See ya.